This is an ABC podcast. On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
Do you think there is life on other planets?
Well, I'm not quite sure, but I suppose there would be.
Definitely. How do you see this life and where?
I've seen a flying saucer.
You've seen one?
Yes, definitely. At Lane Cove.
When was this?
1953.
You don't think this is a figment of your imagination?
Several other people with me saw it.
You all had the same figment. What did it look like?
Colours coming out of it. It was a rion.
And you think this was sent from another planet,
didn't it? I really do. Well, where else would it come from?
In your opinion, do you think there is life on other planets?
No, I hope not.
Why do you hope not?
Because they'd be frozen to death.
Do I think there's life on other planets? No. I don't think we'll find life.
We might find
very interesting things, though. But I dare say it'll be something worth knowing.
Well, it's taken me a really long time, but today we're going there. We're talking UFOs and whether or not there is, or if you believe there could be life on other planets. So why now? Why do I have the confidence to talk about it now? Well, there's actually been a little bit of a global shift in attitudes towards, I guess, what has been the taboo subject of UFOs. The idea that if you believe in life on other planets that you have to wear a tinfoil hat and that whole stereotype is slowly falling away. Now that's thanks to NASA as well as the US Department of Defense. They're all having real conversations at the moment. There's funding, there's research, there's even expeditions into the discovery of life, whatever that looks like, on other planets. So whether you believe or not, the fact is we've always been fascinated in the areas of UFOs, or UAPs as they're known now by the military, and we'll go into that and why that change has occurred a little later in the program. So why do we care if there is life on other planets? Why are we still obsessed with UFOs and life on other planets? And what actually constitutes life on another planet? Very big difference between a walking, talking alien and a little bit of space dust. So the question that you just heard and the question that we've been asking forever is, do you believe that there is life on other planets?
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
Do you think there is life on other planets?
Well, I'm not quite sure, but I suppose there would be.
I think there is life on other planets.
And how do you see this life?
It's like queer-looking people. Yeah, it all depends what atmosphere they're living in. I think it'd be an animal form, but I don't think it'd be like us.
So why all of a sudden do we have the confidence to ask, do you believe in life in other planets? Well, the person you can blame for this, for me asking that question anyhow, is Graham Phillips, who's your co-host today. You would know him as the former presenter of Catalyst, now also a lecturer in science communication at the University of Melbourne. Graham Phillips, a warm welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Thank you. I can't believe I'm coming on the radio to talk about UFOs in Science Week, what's more.
It's Science Week and we're talking UFOs. This was your idea. Not that I want to cast any blame here, but why is there a legitimate conversation now, especially amongst the world of scientists globally, around UFOs and life on other planets? There's been a real shift. Why is that?
It's really interesting. I mean, you're right. There has been an absolute shift because certainly, you know, me growing up and going through the world of science, no one would talk UFOs. It was all just silly talk, you know, as a scientist, don't even talk about it. But we're now in a situation where NASA's recently announced they're going to have a bit of an investigation. We had the Department of Defense in the US having already published an investigation. And we've got a whole field of astronomy now, which wasn't around when I was a boy, called astrobiology, which is the study of life on other planets. I mean, they don't have any cases of that yet, but there's a whole industry, scientific industry around the world in that, if you like. And so I think it's something that people now are starting to take more seriously. And even the UFO thing has, even though they had to rename it.
So UAP, okay, why has it gone from UFO to UAP?
Well, it sounds much better than UFO, doesn't it? That sounds crazy talk, UFOs. UAP, on the other hand.
I think there's stigma associated with UFO. So what does UAP stand for? Well,
I reckon there's a couple of things there. I mean, UAP stands for Unidentified Aerial Phenomena, and UFO stands for Unidentified Flying Object. So I guess UAP is more general, really. I mean, we're not even assuming these things are objects and flying. You know, they might be some atmospheric phenomenon. So in a way, I think it's sort of making it a bit less specific, But also it's a good PR move, isn't it?
Well,
you know, it's calling something else.
Yeah, and it moves away from the tinfoil hat wearing craziness, I guess, of UFO spotting and what we've known forever of that, you know, there's whether it be conspiracies or if you believe, and there's the believers and the non-believers. When you mentioned there both NASA and the Department of Defense, the US Department of Defense, and that they're starting research, into what way, into what areas and to what level, though?
Well, the story with the defense department, which came first, really, and that is, I must say, it's intriguing, their UFO reports or UAP reports, and they happened off the coast of California back in 2004. They were doing military exercises in the area, and one of the radar operators noticed these strange things appearing on the radar that was sort of flying about in the distance, doing strange things, you know, almost breaking the laws of physics. Well, breaking the laws of physics if we understand them even. But he didn't worry about that. He thought, well, it's, you know, he's focusing on other things, getting the, you know, things ready for the big event. But as the, you know, D-Day got closer and they're going to run this exercise, I thought, well, wait a minute. If they're actual objects out there, we better check them out to make sure that there's nothing, you know, we should worry about. So they sent a couple of fighter pilots out there to have a look. And sure enough, they said they saw things. They saw these objects that were about as big as their planes were, that were shaped like Tic Tacs, they described them, you know, the lolly. And they were maneuvering in weird ways. And so that was in 2004. And it leaked. All that information was kept secret, but kind of leaked onto the net in 2017. And then people got talking about it, of course. Mm-hmm. And one of the fighter pilots did the media circuit. And then I think there was pressure from Congress to the Defense Department to say, well, you know, what's going on here? Let's
hear about
this.
So that was really the catalyst, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And then once the Defense Department released their report, which basically said, look, we don't know what they are, then sort of NASA, I guess, thought, well, you know, they're a serious scientific body. They've got a lot of satellites up there looking down on the Earth, observing things. If there are strange objects lurking around here, you'd think they might have some evidence for it. So for NASA, really, it's just sort of a fact-finding mission. They're going to see if there is some evidence that they could actually carry out a scientific investigation on. So it's very early kind of days.
Why do you think that if they're is evidence, or if there are sightings, whatever evidence looks like, that it's always wrapped around conspiracy, and that for whatever reason, we of those that are outside of that circle shouldn't know about it. Why is conspiracy such a big part of it, do you think?
Yeah, look, I think there's a few things going on there, I reckon. One is, I mean, Defense Department would have investigated a lot of UFO, well, they have investigated a lot of UFO reports over the years because of defense purposes, if nothing else, you know, it could be another country, you know, with some advanced technology. So they would have investigated a lot of them just for that reason. And, you know, they're a fairly secretive organization. They don't release stuff. They keep it secret. So I think that's partly why conspiracy theories have been fueled. And also, people just wonder about that stuff. Yep. People see stuff and they wonder about stuff and think, well, you know, would the government tell us about it? Well, maybe the Defense Department wouldn't. I don't know. I mean, they probably wouldn't if they had some alien technology there. I don't know. So I think that's what sort of caused those conspiracy theories.
Growing up, did you believe? I mean, I haven't even asked you. Do you believe that there is life on other planets, Graham Phillips?
Well, I have a very firm answer on that is, I don't know. look, I reckon
that's life, such a scientist thing to say.
Well, look, that's when it comes to UFOs visiting us. Actually, when life on other planets, I still don't really know, but I reckon there must be. I mean, there must be. Like, the universe is a very, very big place, and it's pretty similar all over the place. You know, there's galaxies all over the place, there's stars all over the place, there's planets. We now know there are planets going around almost every star, and there are a quadrillion squillion of them. That's not a scientific number, but there are a lot of them. And so you're telling me that of all those bodies, there's just one very special one that's got life and none of the others have. I just find that very hard to believe.
And given that technology is just, you know, improving by the second as we go on, you know, versus, say, what we were using 10, 20, 100 years ago, vastly, vastly different.
Yeah, yeah. And so we can now, we're starting to listen to space, trying to find any signals from ET. We're sort of looking at different stars to see if we can see signs of alien mega technology. Like, you know, we build big cities. We build pretty big technology here on Earth. But, you know,
are we looking for alien cities now?
Well, alien mega technology. They give it a more scientific name than cities.
So
come on.
What's alien mega technology?
Well, it's just the idea that, look, you know, we build pretty big things. We build cities and buildings. They're pretty big. Imagine, you know, 1,000 years further advancement. Imagine 1,000,000 years further advancement. You could do some pretty serious things. You could build, for example, solar panels all the way around your sun to collect all the energy you could to power this amazing, you know, futuristic society you have. Well, it turns out if an alien civilization did that, we could see from here. It would have this sort of unusual glow of heat from those panels. So people have looked for them. Haven't found any yet, but they haven't done a lot of searching yet. But in principle, we could find alien mega technology.
Well, text here saying, why don't you ask the public about sightings in Melbourne? I certainly did. 1300 222 774, and you can text as well, 0437 774 774. Whenever people have spoken publicly about maybe seeing something or feeling something that they believe is from another planet, they are often laughed at or heckled, or there's an element of craziness wrapped around what they're doing. You know, I mean, even just like the music that I just played, for example. But there have been multiple sightings and groups of people, or, you know, around schools over the years, over the decades, that have come out, that have been told, that they've been told to keep quiet. But people feel a bit silly talking about it, don't they?
I know I would. And it's always been one of those big dilemmas for me, you know, being a science journalist and a former scientist. What if I did see something like that? Would I talk about it? Or would I just keep it to myself? Because people would think I was nuts. Mm. And that's true. And I think that's terrible, really, because, you know, I'm a big believer in science. And, you know, whether science can investigate this UFO phenomenon, whether there's enough actual kind of evidence that science could examine, we're still to sort of work out, really. But that's the only way forward. You've just got to look at the evidence.
Well, let's bring Mitch Schultz into this. He is the science manager on a number of NASA's Mars programs. He's in Australia for Science Week. Mitch, you're joining us from our Ultimo studios in Sydney. A warm welcome to the Conversation Hour, especially during Science Week. Is it rare for NASA to now say, look, we are going to spend time, money and research investigating whether or not there is life on another planet? Because NASA, you know, it holds a lot of respect. Is this something that shocked you in any way?
Well, I do want to be careful a little bit here as a member of NASA, not to wade too deeply into this debate, as you've just discussed. But from a scientific perspective, essentially, you know, we're interested in understanding what makes things the way they are, you know, what's happening. It's, again, a very interesting scientific question. And just because things are unidentified doesn't mean they're not real. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily what people think they are. So, you know, from that perspective, I think it's worth at least thinking about.
Yeah. G'day, Mitch. It's Graham here. Yeah, that's a really good point, I think. I mean, just because they're unidentified doesn't mean they're aliens, and it doesn't mean that they're just imagined either. There could even be a new atmospheric phenomenon, right, that we're not aware of. I mean, it could be anything, but certainly worthy of investigation, you would think.
Yeah, as an example, you know, when we first started sending spacecraft out into the outer solar system, you know, we didn't know a lot about the atmospheres of those giant planets. You know, now that we've had spacecraft observing them for a while, we've seen these, you know, big flashes of lightning and all this other kind of stuff, and you know, it's things that we didn't necessarily expect. But of course, once you see them and then you start investigating why they're there, then of course you can come up with all kinds of good, rational, scientific reasons for these events. And similarly, you know, if you see something happening here in the atmosphere, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's aliens. It just means that it's something we haven't figured out yet. And so, again, from a scientific perspective, it's worth thinking about.
So the amount of work that's going into Mars and that you're working on in the research into Mars, and every time I know that you said that you've been to Mars, you learn something new and you're sort of trying to establish whether or not there has previously been some form of life on Mars, and looking at everything from liquid through to dust and rocks. What is it about Mars, and what are you trying to, every time you bring something back or you investigate something there, what are you looking for?
Well, so far we've only returned data from Mars. So we send spacecraft there and they send back data, you know, pictures and measurements from various kinds of instruments. So we haven't actually returned anything from Mars yet. We're working on that, which we can talk about later if you like. But every time we go there, we go to either, you know, we send an orbiter, which is high in orbit. And so your resolution is only as good as it can be from orbit. We put things on the ground. It's a very small part of the planet. So, you know, we're talking about a big planet, even though it's small relative to Earth, but it would be like landing something in the middle of Sydney and saying you knew everything there was to know about Earth based on what you found in that particular place. So this is why we keep investigating things. Part of the other reason is because, Mars geologically, especially long ago, very, very similar to what we think Earth was like early in its history and what Earth is sort of like now. So the potential for life to have developed from a geologic perspective is reasonable. And so that's one of the things that we're interested in. Again, by comparison with what we know about how life started on Earth, which isn't fully complete story, by the way, but by comparison with looking at places on early Earth and Earth now and where life is able to exist, and then seeing similar kinds of environments in Mars's past, we think it's reasonable to expect that it's at least possible.
Mm. We might go into that in a little more detail in just a moment, but Rob's in Montmorency. Morning, Rob.
Morning, how are you going?
Good, what did you want to say?
Oh, I had a couple of quick things that, you know, I think you might have touched on, really, the idea of the Drake equation suggesting that it would be almost unfathomable to be alone in the universe, you know, based on the number of stars and planets that we know exist. But, yeah, I did once also see what I'd call a UFO. In hindsight, I'd say it was probably a couple of satellites, but it was just a remarkable moment 30-odd years ago when I was a kid.
So, Rob, did you tell many people about what you saw?
No, I mean, I've mentioned it, but I certainly didn't go around saying, oh, my God, I've seen a UFO.
Yeah, I can understand that. Yeah, it's actually, you brought up that Drake equation, which is really just sort of a way of working out what the odds of, you know, another civilization are in the galaxy. And the trouble is we don't know a lot of numbers to plug into that equation. I mean, there's some people who legitimately argue, and gee, the arguments are pretty strong, that we might be the only intelligent species in the galaxy, maybe even the observable universe, because just so many flukes were involved for the human race to get there. You know,
that's
even
just it, you know. It's also the timing too, you know. I mean, if they we may or may not exist, they might not be intelligent, but it could have been millions of years ago or millions of years in the future.
Yeah, yeah.
Is this something you're still interested in, Rob?
Yeah, look, I'm a fan of The X-Files and all those kinds of things, so yes.
Yeah, The X-Files has got is to blame for a lot of this, I think. We of a certain age. Good on you, Rob. Yeah. Thank you. I know you're on your way to work, so we'll let you go. But, I mean, that sort of, again, touches on the fact that us just normal people, us normal citizens, even if we believe or if we see something or we research something, we are still a little bit afraid to talk about it.
It does sound a bit crazy. I mean, Mitch, with Mars, you know, what does it mean if we, like, on Mars, the best we might do, right, is find a microbe. We know there are no big aliens there, right? Or is that some NASA secret that you're not telling us? But, you know, the best we're going to do is find a microbe or two there. What would that be a significant thing? Why would that be so significant?
Well, it would point out that, you know, life is sort of a more common thing than people once thought, right? For a long time, we were all like, we're the only ones in the universe. Now we're finding planets, as you've mentioned, around thousands of stars, and that's just looking at a very small piece of the sky. So finding a second example, I think, would be, you know, sort of groundbreaking in that regard, that it's probably more common and more of a result of the, you know, geologic processes than we imagined.
What do we here on planet Earth stand to learn from the research of other planets?
Oh, lots of different things. So a very good example is climate. So if you, for example, you look at the climate of Venus right now, it's about 450 degrees at the surface and about 90 atmospheres of carbon dioxide. So this was an example of what we call the greenhouse effect gone wild, where so much carbon dioxide built up in the atmosphere of Venus that it's completely baked the surface, and it's, you know, very tough, very tough place to be for now, because it's 450 degrees at the surface, and you'd be crushed by the atmosphere. So, those are examples. Mars, of course, went the opposite way. It would probably had liquid water at the surface early in its history, but in its climate changed. It essentially lost most of its water at the surface. The planet completely dried out, and now it's a cold, dry desert. And so if life had started on Mars, as an example, if it were to want to survive that massive climate change, it would have had to have retreated underground near the heat sources, perhaps near the volcanic regions, things like that. Mm. So those kinds of studies can tell us a lot about what's happening on Earth. And, of course, by comparison, we learn a lot not only about those planets, but about a little bit about ourselves as well.
And when you say life on other planets and what, you know, and climate change would have had to have retreated under the earth. I mean, they're all things that maybe people at first are listening and rolling their eyeballs, and then you think, oh, hang on a second, this is starting to sound a little bit like us. But when you're talking about life, are you talking about animal form? You know, are you talking about actual human type form? What sort of life, when you say life, what are you talking about?
No, well, Graham had this exactly right. Even on Earth, a lot of the organisms on Earth right now are single-celled microorganisms. Plants make up the bulk of the biomass because they've figured out really well how to take advantage of sunlight. But there's a vast underground biosphere here, even here on Earth, that's primarily composed of single-celled microorganisms. And animals make up a very, very small percentage of the amount of biology on the planet. So what we're talking about probably are single-celled organisms. If there were, you know, animals at the surface, even with our limited resolution from orbit, we would have seen things that, you know, were macroscopic, let's say.
So, Rochelle, let me put it to you.
Yes.
If they discovered, you know, simple microbes on Mars, would you care?
I don't know. I'd have to be told why, like why it matters to us. I find it interesting and I think it would be fascinating. And I'm not saying it's not worth researching and looking into. How does it relate to my everyday life? I'm not sure.
I reckon it's like an existential thing. I mean, does it worry you that we might be all alone in the entire cosmos? I mean, the cosmos is very big, maybe infinitely big. Does it concern you that this is it? This is the only planet with any kind of life at all?
I think society is broken into almost two different types. You know, those that have those big questions and think on that big scale. And then there's people like me, when my brain goes there, it implodes a little bit. And I think, I can't even think that big, which is part of the reason why I'm terrible at science and I'm, you know, not a scientist. But I think you either think in that way and you think beyond or you don't.
What about if we discovered a message? Well, did you see the movie Contact all those years
ago?
Little
bits, yes.
Yeah. So
that says a lot about me. Maybe I got up and did the dishes halfway through, I'm not sure.
So basically, you know, their radio telescopes pick up a message from the aliens. They reflect back. Mm-hmm. Do we have a spoiler alert for a movie that old? Maybe not. I don't know. They reflect back our own radio programs to us. And so we pick up some, you know, broadcasts from decades before. What if we did that? Would that impress you?
Yes, 100%. I don't know why there's a difference.
Because there's some intelligent life then.
Yeah. Well, let's have a chat to Michael. He's in Geelong. Hi, Michael.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. What did you want to say?
I keep an open mind on the topic. And, yes, given the numbers involved of galaxies and planets, I do feel that we can't be the only civilization out there. Now, in my youth, I remember a disturbing situation. It was reported on national news. There was a pilot by the name of Peter Valentich. It may have been in the 1980s. And he was flying a single seater plane across Bass Strait and was in live radio contact with authorities and telling them that he was being buzzed by a mysterious object with strange lights. And his final communication, I think, was that the object was directly above his plane. All radio communication then ceased. His plane disappeared from radar screens and no trace of it was ever found. I don't know whether there was an inquest or any sort of further investigation and any other alternative explanation was brought forward.
Yeah, look, I remember that story well. You know, it was totally intriguing, and it's exactly as you say it. And look, I don't know if there was, I'm sure there would have been some sort of investigation after that, you would think, but that's often the problem with these sort of, you know, UFA or UAP or whatever we call them reports these days, is what more do you investigate? You know, like if the craft's not there, they can't find it. I mean, what do? You know, it just goes into their, well, that's weird kind of category. And I guess that's one of the reasons why it's a good thing in my mind for, you know, an organisation like NASA that has extreme scientific expertise, has access to all these kind of satellites that are looking down on Earth, at least has a look and says, well, look, you know, is there any data at all that we could possibly investigate some of these things. That's what it's all about, trying to see if it's something that could be investigated, I think.
And Mitch Schultz is with you from NASA, the science manager on quite a number of NASA's Mars programs. It is Science Week, Mitch, and when we think about the crystal ball of the future, of what we will be able to search for, the level of technology and the amount of money and research that will go into some of the work that you're doing, is this just an area that you think will just get bigger and bigger and that more and more research and funding will go into it?
Yeah, we have plans, of course, to bring samples back from Mars. So the Perseverance rover, which is operating on the surface right now with a very sophisticated set of instruments, but it can only do so much. And so it's collecting samples that we're working on plans to bring back. And of course, when you get samples back here on Earth, we have, you know, machines with much more capability that are easier to see all of the kinds of stuff that we're looking for in terms of, you know, potential biosignatures, as we call them, so evidence that life might have left behind on the surface of Mars. It's a lot easier to do that in laboratories here. So I think that's at least one of the things that we have planned for the near future, to get those samples back, to let the scientific community have a crack at looking at them and investigating them in great detail.
Hey, Mitch, what about other places other than Mars? I know that Mars is very attractive for, you know, potential life, but some of those sort of moons of the planets out in the outer solar...
Mars,
you know,
gets all the attention.
It does. It gets all the attention. Oh, yeah. What about Jupiter's moons and Saturn's moons? I mean, we've got worlds out there that have kind of got oceans, right? Really deep oceans under a, sort of a thick layer of ice.
Yeah, that's right.
But could there be life there?
Well, that's one possibility. So, you know, the parallel to those is... so. The situation for Europa, which is one of the moons of Jupiter, and Enceladus, which is one of the moons of Saturn, they have, you know, very thick ice crusts around them because it's very cold out in outer deep outer space. They have very thick ice shells. Underneath those ice shells, they have liquid water oceans. And then at the core of these bodies, they probably have like a rocky center. And so by comparison with some of the things that we see here on Earth, like these deep sea hydrothermal vents, at the bottom of the seafloor, where you have this, what we call black smokers, these geysers erupting from the seafloor, you can imagine that there's a similar thing going on at the base of the oceans on these moons in the outer solar system. And again, here on Earth, when we look at those environments, we see vast amounts of microorganisms living at those high temperatures, taking advantage of the difference between the fluid coming out of these geysers and the seawater around it, and they're living on chemical energy there. So again, even in a place way out in the solar system that's covered by a very thick ice shell, you could imagine that there might be organisms living at the bottom of this ocean on Europa, for example, taking advantage of the chemical energy that's happening because of the interaction of the water and the rocks.
I'm imagining dolphins. Dolphins and fish. And
dolphins living on chemical energy.
Space dolphins.
I think it works against dolphins, but I like the idea of space dolphins.
Dolphin-like creatures. Let's go with that.
Yeah. Mitch, stay with us. Mitch Schultz is with you. He's the science manager from NASA. This text: we have been conditioned to see any discussion around alien life or UAP is crazy. It's a shame that we can't have a curious and open conversation about the topic without downplaying our interest in case other people might think we're a little bit loopy. That's from Denise in Malvern.
This is The Conversation Hour
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Do you think there is life on other planets?
Well, I'm not quite sure, but I suppose there would be.
I think there is life on other planets.
And how do you see this life?
It's rather... like queer-looking people. It all depends what atmosphere they're living in. I think it'd be an animal form, but I don't think it'd be like us.
And it is Science Week, so Graham Phillips is with you. You'd know him as a former Catalyst presenter, now a lecturer in science communication at the University of Melbourne. And Mitch Schultz joins you as well from our studios in Ultimo. He is the science manager on a number of NASA's Mars programs. And we're talking whether or not we do believe in life on other planets. And that doesn't have to mean walking, talking aliens. It can mean anything from... well, dolphins that are living on chemical energy, apparently, Graham. Let's have a quick chat to Rick. He's in Box Hill. G'day, Rick.
G'day, how are you?
Good. What do you want to say?
My wife and myself were travelling, it was going back a couple of years ago, about an hour and a half south of Surfers Paradise along the coast. And she just bought herself a new iPhone and was practising taking photographs out the window. And she had it on burst mode, and I think it takes about 7 photos per second. Anyway, she did a catch on burst mode, and in the smack bang in the middle of all these photos was a strange looking craft. And So she showed me straight away, and we didn't stop. We sort of pulled over a bit and had a look in the sky. We couldn't see anything. But next day, we stayed very, very close to where this photograph was taken. Next day, we set off, and I was driving, and I had a really good view of the horizon, and this same-looking thing flashed from left to right, and it was going so quickly. It was almost to the point, if we didn't have had this photo, I would have just dismissed it as what the hell was that, you know? But, there was something we caught in the middle of this photograph, and
to this day, you don't know where it is. You know what I always find fascinating? When you see something that's just out of the ordinary, where do we go? And I'll put this probably both to you, Graham, and to Mitch, before we have a chat to Claire Kenyon, who's joining us as well. Where does Rick go to get information on this without sounding like a crazy person?
Yeah, look, I don't know.
Who do you ring? Who do you ask?
I imagine Mitch is not going to say, ring us at NASA.
No.
Because there'd be a lot of people calling up. Yeah.
Well, there used to be a hotline. Remember, it shut down only in about 2000, where you could call and, you know, either list or describe what you'd seen. I mean, imagine being the other person on the other end. I'm pretty sure it's probably just some form of voicemail, but that's disbanded now.
Yeah, look, I don't know. I'm sure there are people probably around that are interested in gathering these stories, but I don't know. Mitch, do you have any advice on that one?
No, you know what? I don't.
It's very different, isn't it? I mean, and that's the interesting thing when you talk about NASA and some of the incredible work that's being done there and the searches that you do, that everybody thinks that you're looking for alien forms. And in actual fact, when we're talking about life on other planets, it's not that at all, Mitch, is it?
No, and again, what we try to do is base what we're looking for on what we know, right? So that's the easiest connection to make, life as we know it. And of course, that comes with its own set of issues in terms of, you know, would you recognize something as being alive if it wasn't exactly like what you're looking for? But primarily, we're interested in, you know, understanding the environments where life might exist, and then trying to figure out what kinds of life forms could actually exist there. So we're not, I mean, again, here in the solar system, if there were, you know, if there was other intelligent life, we would have detected that way by now. And then even looking at planets, you know, around other stars, this technology is really just developing, and we're detecting these planets, but we don't really know a lot about them. We know how big they are. We know how fast they go around their stars, but we don't really know a lot more about them. We don't know the compositions of the atmosphere. So there's a lot of work yet to do there. And we're not particularly in the business of listening for alien signals, but we're interested in investigating these places sort of for what they are and what they can tell us about that potential.
I mean, NASA has in the past, I think, invested in those sort of programs to listen for alien signals, I think a few decades ago, right? But they're not currently.
Yeah, you know, honestly, I don't remember exactly whether we did invest in that. I know there's the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which is a private organization based out in California, and they've gotten their funding from various sources through the years, and I honestly don't remember if NASA provided any of that or not.
Mitch, thanks so much for your time. I know you're busy, and happy Science Week.
Yeah, happy Science Week, and thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Mitch.
That's Mitch Schultz. He's the science manager on a number of NASA's Mars programs. And you're just talking there about listening. So there's the idea of what we see, some of the visuals, some of the data that is brought back from other planets. But there's been a big shift in what we can hear. And Claire Kenyon is an astrophysicist. She's just finished off her PhD in astrophysics at the University of Melbourne. And Claire, this is a lot of what you're looking into in terms of listening out in other planetary systems.
Good morning, and hello everybody, and thank you for having me on. Look, this isn't actually part of my academic PhD, but certainly since I've joined the science writing team at Cosmos, I am doing science journalism, and I must say this is one of the biggest questions that we've got going into the next sort of decade or even the next 100 years, really, is are we alone? And if we aren't, What is there? And if we are, what does that actually mean? Graham, I loved your sort of meta existential question, because frankly, if we are alone, oh my goodness, does that mean
how boring
that,
would that be?
Our civilization might be doomed.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's scary that we're alone, but it's also scary that, you know, the galaxy could be inhabited by beings that may be like us. We're not very nice.
A few people are sending in texts in a similar way saying, God, I hope they're better than the human race.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. And a lot of what Mitch was saying about looking for life outside of Earth and in terms of microbes and looking for environments where life might be suitable for outside of Earth can possibly even relate back to what we've just said there about looking for a planet B, because frankly, you know, if we don't get our acts together here, we may be looking for places to move to. So there's actually another whole side thing to this that sort of we haven't even really touched on, which is equally frightening, I must admit.
Yeah, the freight costs are going to be pretty high getting us to another planet, I think. But it's interesting, this idea of actually, you know, being slightly afraid of having aliens out there is, you know, there's this, as well as listening, you know, we have our radio telescopes that are listening to the universe, trying to pick up alien messages and signals. But we also can turn them around and broadcast. And we've done that, actually.
So already. What did we say?
Well, we've said all sorts of things, told them a bit about where we are, you know, what we look like, come and eat us. No, and that's the issue, is it? Right, Claire, you mean Claire could tell us more about us, but some people are saying, well, wait a minute, you shouldn't be yelling out in a jungle full of dangerous animals that you're there. You shouldn't be telling the aliens you're there, you know. Just shut up, sit quiet, listen.
I totally agree. Oh, my goodness. So, yes, we've been listening for a long time, and actually Mitch was kind of on the money there. NASA pulled out of the SETI program in 1993. So that was actually privately funded from then. And so we've been listening to, you're quite right, Graham, radio signals, but also more recently for optical and sort of laser signals as well. So we've been listening, but you're quite right. Oh my goodness. We have been sending messages out actually since 1962. We've sent at least 11 radio messages out into different areas and sent out 4 physical artifacts as well. And they sort of tell anybody that happens to be listening who we are, where we are, what we look like, and actually, in a way, what we're actually capable or not capable of, which I must admit, we're looking for intelligent life and we're broadcasting. I'm not really sure how intelligent that is.
Maybe it's like sending out a dinner menu, is it, perhaps?
Well, it's very strange. It's almost like setting up a Tinder profile. Like, what do you say about yourself? Like, and we're all very different. So what's the key message that
the messages have been pretty simple, right, Claire? Because, I mean, there's only you're sending them out as a radio signal for a start.
That's correct, yeah. So some of them were obviously, the Morse message was the first one in 1962, and that actually went to Venus. And then after that we had a very famous Arecibo message, which went to Messier 13, which is a globular cluster. And globular clusters tend to be quite old stars, so we're sort of banking on the fact that we need a little bit more time for civilization, if that's what we can call ourselves, to evolve to the point where they can be technologically savvy enough to pick up messages. The most recent one was actually probably only 5 years ago or so, and there may have been one since then. So we tend to send things like, you know, what does hydrogen look like to us? What do we look like? On the physical messages, we've sent Voyager and Pioneer. So they left our galaxy and out they go. On Pioneer, we had these gold anodized aluminium plaques, and they actually had pictures, Rochelle, of us naked. Not me and you, but a generic male and a female with all the bits and pictures of where we are with respect to the nearest pulsars to Earth. So it was actually telling anybody out there that happened to chance upon this spacecraft exactly where we were. And then the Voyager went out and they had messages actually from, do you remember Carl Sagan was big in this area for a long time. It was a golden record and it had images and sounds of Earth, so things like babies crying and thunder and you know, waves crashing on Earth's surface, which is really quite beautiful. But as I said before, I'm still not quite sure how much that says about our
It sounds like you have a seriously cool job, Claire. I mean, that all sounds so exciting. Is that what your day-to-day, I mean, what does your day-to-day working life look like in astrophysics and using radio telescopes, trying to detect messages, send messages? Is it that exciting every day?
I wish. So I actually work in a completely sort of different field. I work with these things called quasars or active galactic nuclei, and they are essentially really large, galaxies that are a long way away, and they're very, very, very bright because the black hole right in the middle, which is about, you know, a million to a billion times the mass of the sun, it eats a lot of material. And as the material sort of falls into the black hole, it heats up and shines really brightly. So my day to day is actually, believe it or not, studying how dense the gas is around the black hole and how much light it receives. And that is my PhD in a nutshell. Wow. It's a little bit more complicated than that. But yeah, I'm studying some seriously extreme and cool things right at the very edges of what we can see in our universe and sort of right near the beginning of, I suppose, time. So that gets me up in the morning.
Michelle looks like her mind is blown.
Absolutely. I am in awe of people like you, Claire, that not only have the ability to do that, but there's always this intense passion that's wrapped around it. And we have you to thank, you know, because this, it's huge. Where did your interest in this start, Claire?
Oh, my goodness. I think I've always been a bit of a science geek, I guess. I got distracted by music and sport for a bit as a kid. But, yeah, I like to credit it to my mum who took me out to see Halley's Comet when I was, I think, two or something.
See, that's where I failed, right? I stayed in bed.
Yeah, you didn't get up to see Halley's.
Dad's like, get up. Yeah. Halley's Comet. I'm like, no, I can't be bothered.
I got up and thought, oh, is that it? I think I'll squint. Yes, I think
that's it. That's so funny.
I'd grown up with the pictures in the books as a kid thinking Halley's Comet is going to be magnificent. But, of course, it wasn't as bright as it sometimes is for that one. But it's interesting how those kind of events can have a big effect on a kid, right?
Yeah. It's also funnily enough, you know, the whole, like, this fish is bigger, it was this big and it gets bigger every year, the one that you caught, like, back in 1992. It's the same thing with when I talk to the people at some of the astronomical societies around the country. They go, oh, I saw it. You know, some people are like, oh, it was not a very good showing. And they're like, oh, no, it was amazing. And every time you talk to them, it gets better and better and better and brighter before it's, you know, taking up the entire sky. So I think it's amazing from the sense that it's sort of one of those once-in-a-lifetime things. But comets themselves actually aren't that rare. It's just not as common to see something so bright and iconic, I suppose, yeah.
What a joy to speak with you, Claire. Thanks so much and happy Science Week.
Oh, thank you. You too. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Claire.
That's Claire Kenyon, just finishing her PhD in astrophysics. You're on The Conversation Hour. My name's Rochelle Hunt, your co-host today, Graham Phillips. You may recognise that voice from Catalyst, now also a science and communication lecturer at the University of Melbourne. Ross Coulthart, you would know him from his novel In Plain Sight, and of course you'd also know him, well, from many shows, including 60 Minutes, the Channel 7 ongoing spotlight series on UFOs. Or you may have listened to his podcast, Need to Know, where Ross, I just listened to the latest episode of that. And you and your co-host are very, very excited at the moment about a number of things. In particular, what's getting you so excited?
The US Congress, hello there, and thank you for having me on. The US Congress has basically decided that it's taking UFOs, UAPs as they call them, seriously. Nobody's saying it's little green men from Zeta Reticuli, but what they have done, quite extraordinary, as a result of various confidential briefings that have been held on the Hill by witnesses from the US military mainly, the US Congress, key politicians on both sides, in a bipartisan move, have passed or moved to pass legislation which would essentially make it a requirement for Congress to be told what the US military and the US intelligence services know about hidden UFO programs inside the US government, something that's previously been the subject of tinfoil hat conspiracy theories, is now being seriously canvassed.
And why all of a sudden, do you think?
Well, it's really interesting. The New York Times, you know, probably the world's top newspaper, revealed back in 2017 that, contrary to what we've been told for so many years, the US government has indeed been investigating UFOs, or unidentified aerial phenomena, UAPs, as they're being more politely known these days. And it turns out the US Navy in particular is getting very, very concerned about anomalous phenomena which has been detected on multiple sensor systems, irrefutably showing that there are objects doing things that are beyond known human science. In some cases, they're believed to be intelligently controlled. They're doing hypersonic speeds, tens of thousands of kilometers an hour. They're doing instantaneous velocity, going from zero to 10,000 K in the blink of an eye. They're doing transmedium, going from air to water, water to air, and indeed into orbit. They've got stealth capabilities. They can literally disappear and make themselves invisible. I know this sounds like science fiction, but it's the fifth observable that is the most interesting. They appear to be demonstrating positive lift without any visible means of propulsion. And that's suggestive of possibly anti-gravity. And even Bill Nelson, the NASA administrator, is one of very senior officials in the US government who've come out after briefings where he's been shown these confidential videos that are still being kept secret by NASA and by the US military. And these videos have so convinced people like Bill Nelson, who's a decent chap, he's a former congressman, also a former astronaut, and he's basically come out publicly and canvassed the possibility, only the possibility, that this might be explainable as non-human technology.
I'll just jump in there, Deb Ross. It's certainly intriguing. Those observations, I think, are off the coast of California are really intriguing, I think. I mean, I think it's too early to say, you know, whether they're alien or whatever, but as you say, they certainly, you know, on face value, are doing some weird kind of things. If they are objects, then they're certainly doing some weird
things. So how do you find out? So the idea of, well, are they objects? And yes, we can see these on, you know, video or film or whatever it may be. How do you then take it to that next step investigate?
That is the big question. And I know a physicist who's going out there, you know, hiring a boat in that area and going out there and trying to gather some more data and evidence. But that's the tricky bit. I mean, these are, you know, credible observers, absolutely, you know, in the military. And as they describe them, if they're physical objects, they're breaking the laws of physics as we know them. But How do you gather further evidence to say, wait a minute, maybe it was an atmospheric phenomenon or maybe it was something else, you know, you need to gather more data.
Well, they've actually ruled out the possibility that it is atmospheric phenomena. This is the really interesting thing is that I've had briefings with intelligence officials, people in the US military, who are quite open with me as a professional journalist, that this is something they cannot explain.
Yeah.
I've spoken to people in the Congress, very senior people at a high level in the US Congress just in the last few weeks, who say, look, we're not jumping to conclusions. Nobody's saying it's alien. One of the possibilities that we're looking at still is the possibility that it's an undisclosed foreign adversary, maybe China or Russia. But they strongly doubt it. And indeed, you know, people like John Brennan, a former head of the CIA, openly talk now about the possibility that this is a non-human intelligence.
But really, it's too early to say. And as you just said, you've just come back from the United States and spent time with all of these people. And in Australia, many people know your work and respected work, you know, as we said earlier, from 60 Minutes. This is an ongoing series and the Spotlight series on Channel 7. Is there a difference in opinion or acceptance between the United States and Australia? So when you go to release some of this information, give some of the facts that you've just given us now and put it on mainstream television, or you just talk to people in Australia, is there a difference of belief and opinion in the two countries?
Look, there isn't really. I mean, privately, I'm talking to even an F-35 pilot in the Australian Air Force who's told me he's seen anomalous phenomena. I've spoken to numerous military and civilian pilots who've recorded this phenomena and reported it up the line. And I don't think there's a conspiracy. One of the things people often think is that there's sort of dark forces going around covering this up. I actually don't think that's the case. I just think that Australia, like the Americans were for many, many years, is doing what you know, a lot of countries have done. They don't like admitting that they really have no idea.
So is that where the conspiracies come in, do you think, or we're told that government agencies are withholding information and, you know, we're not being told this? Is that because no one knows what's going on and everyone's just a little bit embarrassed?
No, look, it's actually a matter of public record now that the United States is particularly sitting on videos, evidence which it's still keeping secret. And let me say, I mean, I say this as a journalist, and I'll probably get raspberries for saying this. If I was a scientist in NASA or a senior official in the intelligence services, I would probably keep this secret too. Because frankly, if this is some kind of advanced technology, and I'm assuming, Graham, you're on side with me on this one as well, we want it. You know, it would be fantastic to have this technology. Wouldn't it be wonderful to develop anti-gravitics? And we know the Americans were working on it secretly during the 50s and the 60s, and then it suddenly disappeared. And people like Ben Rich, who was the head of Skunk Works at Lockheed Martin, he always hinted that they'd had major breakthroughs. So I'm still holding the possibility that what we're looking at here is undisclosed American technology that's hidden somewhere in private aerospace. And maybe there's a large section of the US military and intelligence services that just don't know about it. But what's interesting is there are intelligence officials, military officials, I've spoken to politicians who freely acknowledge that there's been a cover-up, that the United States for many years presided over a position which basically said all of this phenomena could be prosaically explained. And ever since June last year, when a report came in from the UAP task force to the US Congress, that's not been the case anymore. It's been unsustainable. The Congress was told that the Pentagon formally admitted that UAPs, whatever they are, are a genuine, authentic mystery worthy of investigation.
And there's a task force associated to it, and that's something that we throw at everything that we don't understand here as a task force.
Exactly.
Ross Coulthart, thanks so much for your time. Your book is called In Plain Sight. The podcast, which I've just been listening to a couple of eps, is called Need to Know. And the Spotlight series on UFOs is, of course, on Channel 7. Thanks so much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
It does feel like the conversation is shifting, though, and more people, like people that would know Ross, they'd know him from 60 Minutes. You know, he's a respected journalist. It's kind of become his life's work a little bit to look into this.
Yeah.
So people do become a bit obsessed. It's the idea of cover-ups, though, that I always go, really? Why are we covering it up?
Yeah,
why would that be necessary?
Yeah, I guess if it's the military, I can understand. They wouldn't. It's not so much a cover-up as they just wouldn't publicise that kind of stuff. And I think, I mean, all we can do, I mean, all these things are possible, and those weird objects doing weird things, I mean, personally, I can't see that be some other country's technology. I mean, they're travelling at enormous speeds, you know, 80 Gs, the acceleration 80 Gs. You know, a pilot passes out, what, at about 6? The wings fall off a plane at about 13. I mean, that's just breaking the laws of physics as we know them, you know. So
that's what spins me out.
It's not going to be Earth technology.
My hat's gone.
It's either aliens or something else, I think.
And what's the something else if it's not aliens?
And the weird thing is, I mean, you can't rule out aliens really because, you know, there are plenty of star systems in our galaxy that are a billion years older than our star system. So imagine if life got going there, you know, in principle, they could be a billion years more technologically advanced. Imagine that. You know, what we couldn't imagine that. That's the thing, you know. So in principle, it's possible, but we need the evidence.
I love that during Science Week, we talk about UFOs and we do it happily. Graham Phillips, thank you. Take care and I'll speak with you tomorrow.